Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This panel of the court today has six cases on its calendar, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and three of which will be submitted without oral argument solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A19-632, Michael Paulke versus Commissioner of Public Safety. Mr. Durkin, you may approach and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, ladies and gentlemen in the back behind me. Good morning. My name is Rory Patrick Durkin, and I represent the petitioner in this case, Michael Thomas Paulke. Your Honors, the issue in this case is basically whether or not the district court abused its discretion when it excluded expert testimony at our implied consent hearing. I noted a couple of weeks ago there was a case that came down called Bruce Andrew Olson versus Commissioner of Public Safety, which was a very similar case, almost identical. And I also noted that counsel filed a motion to rely on that. What I would like to point out about that case and what I think is and where we differentiate and what is distinct in Mr. Paulke's case is footnote 3 in that particular case that basically stated Olson wasn't challenging the admissibility of the results but seeking to introduce additional evidence concerning whether the test results were accurately evaluated, basically relying strictly on that subdivision 10. I would like to point out that at the district court level and at this level, we have always relied on subdivision 10 and subdivision 8 as well, where we are challenging the test result at the 0.16. So that's how I think that we differentiate that particular case. Your Honors have been dealing with this issue since the 80s with Schultz v. Commissioner of Public Safety. What I'd like to say about bias and uncertainty of measurement briefly, and I am not a scientist. I don't claim to be a scientist. I never will be. I don't always understand all of this stuff. That's the purpose of expert testimony, and that's why we have experts. But what I can tell Your Honors is that margin of error and uncertainty of measurement are two very distinct issues. They're
how,
not
how so?
Conceptually.
How are they different? I mean, we almost talk about them interchangeably. What's the difference in in the context of an implied consent hearing and the implied consent law between margin of error and uncertainty of measurement? That's when I was reading the briefs, I was having a hard time understanding the difference and whether it makes a difference in light of our precedent that says it's speculative evidence and not admissible in any event.
Well, and what we're not necessarily talking about, we're talking about uncertainty of measurement, and also we're talking about bias. Those are three different issues. Margin of error deals with a range that a particular machine, and I think, and like I said, I am not a scientist, but margin of error is, I believe, a range of accuracy that a particular machine can fall within. Okay, this particular intoxilizer or data master is accurate with a range of, a margin of error, meaning it could be in error from 0.02 greater or 0.02 less. Uncertainty of measurement, my understanding of the issue, and like I say, that's why we have experts to come tell us and teach us this. Uncertainty of measurement is the basis with which we it goes to what's called measurand, M-E-A-S-U-R-A-N-D, which is basically how we determine an entire group of machines can be uncertain. And I believe in the Olson case, the expert was going to testify that with respect to uncertainty of measurement in that case, that there was an 80% chance that the machines were accurate or that the blood alcohol concentration, there was an 81% chance that the petitioner's blood alcohol concentration could fall within that range, which is different from a margin of error that would say, well, this machine is accurate. And like I said, I'm not a scientist and I don't have a complete understanding of them, but they are not conceptually identical.
Are you sure that's not the McIntyre case, the 80%?
You're right. That was the McIntyre case, not
right.
the Olson case.
I think
case.
The Olson
right.
case. You know,
that's right.
I had the same
that's
question as Judge Flory, and I mean, ordinarily we would be able to understand these concepts with a more explicit proffer, quite often an expert's written report. We don't have that in this case, right? The proffer is simply, I think, your one-page letter or your co-counsel's one-page letter. Not one page, it's more than one page, but it has one paragraph saying we're going to have a witness who will testify to. We don't have a written explanation of these concepts that you're telling us about now in the record, do we?
We do not, but in the petitioner's memorandum of law, what we do have is the petitioner states, notably in this case, or this expert will testify that the bias affecting the test results, like petitioners, have been recorded up to 6 times higher and at the 0.16 level than what is more tolerable at the 0.8 level. He'll also testify that the impact of bias on the data master result is significant and that the consensus standard for dealing with any bias that is significant requires that the final measurement will be corrected to account for that bias. In many respects, that's kind of similar to Schultz v. Commissioner of Public Safety, where in that case, the Court of Appeals held that the district court did not abuse its discretion when it subtracted the overage amount. Basically, the simulator solution was running a bit high. It's running a 0.002 or 0.03 high. And in that case, the district court judge subtracted that from the reported value. So I think that in the petition and in our memorandum of law that we submitted to the district court judge, I think there was a significant proffer where they didn't talk about just in general the way I think that they were quite specific when we indicated that this expert would testify that this particular machine and this particular test had some issues. And Your Honors, as I stated for the fifth time, I am not an expert, and this case really is about allowing the expert to come in and testify, and the district court denying it.
This might be an aside, but is it proper to call this person an expert in the sense that, I mean, you have not retained this person, right?
Well, we subpoenaed him. It was the BCA's expert.
Yeah, you don't subpoena experts usually. This is an adverse, I don't know the relationship exactly between the BCA and Department of Public Safety, but this is a person, you're subpoenaing this person to get, I think, more of their fact testimony than expert testimony.
Well, I believe that he's testified many times, and I believe has been qualified as an expert in this area.
And compensated pursuant to Rule 45?
That I'm not sure of, and I honestly don't have the particulars with respect to that issue.
And what's the person's name in this case?
David Adine.
Last name?
Adine.
Adine, okay. But he did not do a written report stating his opinions relevant to this case?
That's correct. He showed up, but he did not.
Pursuant to subpoena?
Correct. And he did not prepare a written report. That is correct. And I don't know how that's relevant with respect to whether or not he can testify as to the results.
I agree. I think I noted this might be a digression. Those issues are not raised, but I guess I'm not sure. you've been referring to him as an expert, and I'm just not sure if he's an expert witness or if so how. But could I ask another question about the record? Is there in the record the typical one-page printout from the data master showing the two reported values and then the ultimate reading?
I believe that it is part of the record, and it was put into evidence by the Commissioner of Public Safety at the original implied consent hearing.
And do you remember the two reported values?
I believe it was 0.16, right on the money. Oh, the two reported values that were rounded out? If I could have just a second.
Yeah, probably a three-digit number.
Know that it was 0.16 something.
I can always search the record again. I didn't find it on my first time through, but
I thought that it was entered into. I mean, that's generally how these
right.
go. And I did not appear at the very first implied consent, but I'm pretty sure that it was part of the record.
Regardless, and if you want to talk about asides, I think what's interesting in it seems that the Commissioner of Public Safety has tried to hamstring us in any way, shape, or form with respect to challenging the accuracy and reliability of these particular tests.
Well, back in, I'm sorry, and I understand your point there, but my question is, I didn't see anything in the record that indicated that your expert was going to be able to say that these tests were in fact affected by machine bias or uncertainty of measurement, only that it's possible that could have been.
Well, he did not say that because he wasn't allowed to, but we stated in our brief and in the initial and original memorandum and the letter requesting permission to file a motion for reconsideration pursuant to the rules of general practice, and that's the letter that we're referring to, mm-hmm. Your Honors. We did state that this particular machine is affected by it. And so I think that is not correct. And I read it. I mean, the petitioner's expert will testify that the impact of bias on this machine and on this test is significant, and especially at the 0.16 level, and even greater at the 0.16 level. So I do think that that was. And I just wanted to get back to my aside. We had that whole intoxilizer nightmare that lasted for about 5 years. And what happened is a company came to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension with this new data master, and we said, we have the newest machine. It's the greatest and latest technology. It's got infrared technology and fuel cell technology, and it's got two types of tests. So this machine will now take an infrared test and a fuel cell, and you'll get two test results, and we'll have the greatest machine and what happened is when Minnesota bought these machines, what happened is the fuel cell and the infrared testing started to become getting out of skew. So what happened is, rather than having to calibrate all the machines, we simply turned off the fuel cell portion of that machine and now only use the infrared portion of it. And we defense attorneys started challenging those tests and questioning officers on the machine and on the disparity between the two readings, and that they actually just turned off half of the machine. So now what they call this machine on the stand is they call it the Data Master with fuel cell option, which is not what it was called when it was initially purchased by the state of Minnesota.
Isn't that the machine, though, that's approved by the commissioner after this rule proceeding?
Yes, well, it was. Yes.
Aren't you just trying to then kind of redo that rule proceeding? And I just don't see how that's our job. I mean, it was approved by the commissioner, right? Even whatever, it may be right, may be wrong. It's approved. You know, doesn't our case law say that then it's, you know,
I'm not asking you. You're right. It's not your job. It's not. It's the job of the legislature. However, and I don't want this to sound like I'm speaking down to the court, because I have nothing but respect for this body, but it is the job of the court to be the gatekeeper of evidence, and it is the job of this court to allow expert testimony to come in. We have standards for expert testimony and scientific testimony, and if we had a hearing where the experts could testify, and then the district court judge could rule accordingly after hearing the testimony, then maybe the legislature would make the decision that it needs to make. But by hamstringing us, by saying, look, you can't even bring in, we're gonna put in these 10 bases in which you can challenge it. Oh, and one of them is you can challenge, and I think that's 10, you can challenge how it's evaluated, and number 8, you can challenge the test result itself, but then hamstringing us on how we can even challenge that, that seems to be unfair. So, Your Honors, I would respectfully, I see my time is up, I would respectfully request that you reverse the district court and allow and find that the district court abused its discretion when it precluded expert testimony. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Durkin, before you sit down, I guess I'd like to ask one question which picks up on your last point. So you referred to the Olson opinion, which is unpublished, and so it's not precedential, but it cites a number of cases of this court that are published and precedential, such as, I'm just looking at it, Barnell, Lockster, Camp, Dixon, Hernser, Schildgen, Grund, and so on. I mean, do you believe the Olson opinion appropriately interpreted and applied that case law in that case? Or is there some way in which you would critique the reasoning in Olson and urge us to do something different?
Well, I think in most of those cases, testimony was allowed and the district court judge ruled on the basis of that testimony. Here, we don't even have the testimony. So I think that Olson did not appropriately decide those or refer to those.
I thought all of those opinions had to do with admissibility, not with the ultimate factual issue. Do you think otherwise?
I do. Okay. At least with respect, because I think some of those cases talk about margin of error. Almost all of those cases that were relied on had to do with margin of error. And margin of error had been dealt with at the appellate level and the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals with testimony and was determined to be not an issue. Here, with respect to bias and uncertainty of measurement, we haven't had all of the testimony and the expert testimony that could be evaluated. We just simply haven't had it. So I think at some point, sure, once we have margin of error is not uncertainty of measurement or bias. So I don't think it was applied correctly, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Durkin. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, and everyone else here today. My name is Stephen Melcioni, Minnesota Assistant Attorney General here for Respondent Commissioner of Public Safety. I do want to clear up one thing to Judge Johnson's question. The test results in this case were 165 and 167 as to the DMT result, which was stipulated to, I believe, before the hearing even started.
Wouldn't there usually be 3 digits?
Yes, 167 and 165 were the two. 0.167 and 0.165.
I'm sorry, got it.
Yep.
0.165 yep. And 0.167. Thank
Correct.
You.
So this case is really about whether the district court abused its discretion. I think we agree on that standard. This is an abuse of discretion standard. Specifically, we are dealing with a repackaged margin of error argument. This court has long held that margin of error is inadmissible, is not to be relied upon in Lockster, Camp, and Barna. The last question, Judge Johnson, you asked was about whether Olson properly construed Lockster, Camp. And I think it's important for the court to note the facts in Lockster, Camp. In Lockster, Camp, the court admitted the margin of error testimony, admitted that plus-minus testimony, relied on it, and rescinded the revocation. This court determined that was reversible error. So if it is reversible error to admit and rely on it, then the testimony is properly excluded. Why admit testimony that it is reversible error to rely upon? That was the argument I made in Olson. because Loxterkamp reversed the district court for relying on exactly this type of testimony.
So is there some authority you can point to, Mr. Melchione, that, and this goes to appellant's argument, that margin of error, or that the issue in this case is just a repackaging of the margin of error evidence that's been excluded? Because really, we've heard three different terms: machine bias, margin of error, uncertainty of measurement. Is there some precedential authority that says those are all one and the same?
I believe so. Well, there's two unpublished cases, McIntyre and Olson, who both hold that margin of error and uncertainty of measurement are conceptually identical. The court came to the same conclusion in State v. Brazil, which is a published criminal case, essentially holding that margin of error and uncertainty of measurement are identical conceptually. So I think, yes, there is precedent from this court in two unpublished and one published case to say that these are conceptually the same. I think if you want to fold in bias, you have to look at their notice of expert, which is appellant's addendum A1. Their notice says that the expert will be testifying about uncertainty of measurement and traceability. And within that testimony, hypotheticals may arise dealing with bias and how bias is incorporated. So if you look at their notice of expert, it talks about how bias will be a hypothetical situation incorporated into the uncertainty of measurement testimony, because that's what bias is. Bias is one of many things taken into account when calculating uncertainty of measurement. That's why it's alternatively called, and you'll see it in some of the briefing and some of the court cases, systemic error. It's another way of talking about machine error. Bias and systemic error are identical. The other form of error that is referenced is random error, which would be those things that happen that we can't really control for with people and the way people provide tests. I think conceptually, the way we break this down between the testimony that is admissible and the testimony that is not admissible, and going back to Schultz, testimony about this specific case, about how this test was performed, about how this test was administered, is admissible. Testimony about the procedure, the BCA-approved procedure by rule, is not admissible because it is irrelevant under Janung, Hayes, Barna, Schildig. Under all of those cases, testimony purely attacking on a theoretical level the procedures adopted by the BCA and approved in the rule proceeding, those are inadmissible because they're irrelevant.
So if, I'm not saying that's the case here, but if you had a machine that was approved by rule by the BCA, people later thought, this is really not working. There are problems with machines. You're reading articles and papers saying that there are problems with these machines. How could that ever come to light in our court system then if you don't let some expert at some point testify about that? Are you just saying, well, you know, once the commissioner adopts it by rule, unless the legislature overrules it, is that the end?
I think it is. The legislature gets to approve the testing methodology. And what I would note is that Janung, Barna, Hayes all predate the legislature amending the DUI statute to the 08 level. We assume the legislature knows about this court's opinions. So if the legislature wanted to say 0.08 plus margin of error, they could have said that. And they didn't. They said 0.08 as reported by the test, and then allowed the commissioner to approve a testing device. The legislature at any time can change that, or alternatively, it's for the rulemaking proceeding. It's not for each individual court to challenge the testing method, testing procedure.
So go collect all the signatures and get a new rulemaking procedure?
That would be the process. Or appeal the validity of the rule. There's a process for that as well. You can challenge a rule in the state of Minnesota. It is by a direct writ
I've
to this
that.
Court. So I'm sure you are very familiar with it. I know, Your Honor. But I think that's the procedure. If you want to challenge the machine that is adopted to say this machine should not be in use in Minnesota at all, that's a rulemaking challenge.
But
that is not a challenge for each individual case.
But the legislature also said that a petitioner may challenge the reliability and accuracy pursuant to 0.53 subdivision 3B10.
And that is what is discussed.
The Supreme Court has, you know, acknowledge that in the Commissioner of Public Safety case.
Yes, and I think that is exactly what is discussed in Hayes. The difference between challenges to the device as a whole and the difference between challenges to the device as it operated on the night in question. When the statute uses the word method, they're talking about the method on which the test was administered by the officer on the night in question. They're not talking about the overall testing procedure as adopted. Well, I think if you're talking about the Inree Commissioner of Public, sorry.
Well, I mean, 3B10 talks about, I'm trying to find it now, the, I think it refers to the accuracy of the test results in a particular case. I mean, that may be challenged pursuant to the statute, right?
Right, and that is what exactly what is discussed in Hayes. And I think the citation from Hayes that is helpful here, let me get it correctly.
But Hayes was a urine case. It had a different testing protocol, right?
Right, but it was still a 3B10 challenge. And what the court said is 3B10 challenges include the manner in which law enforcement obtained the sample. So in a urine case, that would be how the person urinated into the cup or whether there was powder or whether the sample had been contaminated or stored properly. Those are that's the method challenge that 3B10 entails. And for breath testing, analogous would be whether the machine was in proper working order, it passed its diagnostics, it was, you know, plugged in, those types, whether an observation period was done. Those are all types of challenges that we can address. And if someone says, you know, in this case, there's evidence that my client burped and it impacted the reliability or accuracy of the test, we litigate those cases all the time. That's a weekly occurrence for me. That's just what we do. If there's something about the test, if there's something that happened during the administration of the test, that's what 3B10 is addressing. And that's what the court decided in Hayes, was that 3B10 is really focusing on these individual tests. It's not focusing on the overall procedure that's been adopted by rule. So I think that's the distinction I would draw there. The other thing I would note is that the appellant in this case did not challenge admissibility at the district court level and did not challenge
admissibility of
the test result itself. And I think the addendum I would point to is 7 and 9. So those transcript pages, the first one at A7 talks about how the only challenge is 3B10, which is accuracy reliability, which is after the test has been admitted. It's not challenging the prima facie case. And then at A9, counsel for appellant stated that something to the effect of, just because they've made their prima facie case here doesn't mean we don't get to challenge it. But they weren't objecting to the fact that the prima facie case was made. And to the extent we want to get into that, there was a certified operator. No one disputed that he was certified. No one disputed that the test was a DataMaster DMTG with fuel cell option approved by 7505025. No one disputed that those two items were met and that there was a proper observation period and that the procedure was followed in the case. That's our prima facie case. Once we've met that, the test, by statute, is admissible. Then we can dispute accuracy reliability. What all of the cases that we cite in our brief discuss is an accuracy reliability challenge cannot come down to this theoretical argument that, but we don't know what the true alcohol concentration is, which is exactly what they were arguing at the district court. And the transcript site for that would be A10 and A11. Talking about true alcohol concentration and what's the person's true alcohol concentration. This is this theory that has been repeatedly rejected. Just because every measurand is somewhat uncertain, we never know if anything is actually a foot long or actually weighs a pound. You know, if you get to that theoretical conceptual level, it's impossible to know how tall you are. Factually impossible.
Can I follow up on Judge Jessen's question by asking, can you tell us about a hypothetical situation in which a petitioner could take advantage of 3B10 by challenging the test results following a DataMaster breath test?
Sure. I think some of those examples that we see all the time are interference challenges, where someone says that we believe this test was affected by acetone or ketones. My client's a painter, and they had paint on them, and it was distributing acetone into the air, and we believe it affected the result. We'll have an expert hearing on that all day. Those are the types of challenges. You believe your client, there was mouth alcohol. Your client belched, burped, or vomited into their mouth during the testing process, and it affected the test. Those types of things. It's things that occur during the test. Or if you believe, you know, your client has GERD, We litigate the GERD challenges, gastroesophageal reflux disease. We litigate those challenges all the time. It's those types of challenges that say, in this case, for this test, something happened, which goes back to the cases cited by the district court. It has to be something more than just this metaphysical, speculative, something could have happened, the test result could be different, and this is what the court talked about in McIntyre in Brazil. Really, when you're getting to these uncertainty challenges, you're saying, if my client had done one or two or 10 more tests, one of them could have been below. We don't know. It's possible. And that's the speculative nature of the testimony that is not helpful to the district court. And I would note that the district court in this case really leaned on the unhelpfulness analysis and said, I'm not going to find this testimony helpful because under Loxtercamp, I can't rely on it. I think there's also the Olson analysis, that says this testimony as a matter of law is legally irrelevant because the plus or minus under Loxtercamp, if the court were to admit it and rely on it, it would be reversible error. So that's why the Olson, this court in Olson upheld the grant of the motion in limine because it is legally irrelevant per Loxtercamp and it's an abuse of discretion standard. The court took in the proffer and said, based upon this proffer, based upon your notice and what you told me at the hearing and what you wrote in your brief, this testimony will not be helpful to the trier of fact. And that is the litmus test for expert testimony, whether or not it will be helpful to the trier of fact. So I think that's an important distinction. So with that, I think the point's been made. I think Olson is very on point here. I don't think there's any principled reason to distinguish this case from Olson because as is made plain by all of the argument at the oral argument and the disclosure of the witness, bias is part and parcel of uncertainty, and it does nothing else than give you a theoretical plus minus that may or may not be applied. And that's what the court cited on the last page of their order and really focused on those statements from appellant that the testimony they were seeking to offer was a theoretical plus minus that they believe should be applied instead of the 0.08 that's been adopted by the legislature and approved by the Commissioner of Public Safety via this testing process. So for those reasons, we ask that you affirm the district court's order excluding the testimony in this case.
What if we had two reported values that were 0.160 and 0.160? Would you still be as enthusiastic about the case law that we have at the moment?
I'm always this enthusiastic, but yes, I still would be because that is the testing methodology. And if we had decided that we wanted to do a plus add plus minus, the legislature could have said, all right, let's do the margin of error, but we'll make the legal limit 0.07, 0.14. They've essentially just adopted what is going to be a per se violation, knowing full well what this court's rulings are on this margin of error type testimony. So we have to set a bright line rule. We have set a bright line rule. If the legislature wants to adopt a different rule that incorporates margin of error, they could do that, and maybe they change the legal limit in doing so. Who knows if we become one of those states? But we're not. I only know one that's below 08 right now, but it's not us.
Thank you, Mr. Melchioni. Mr. Durkin, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Just briefly. And he is always that enthusiastic.
You know each other well, I take it.
Well, he's a good lawyer and a smart guy. But once again, we're lawyers. We're not experts. And what you've heard is a lot of facts and a lot of numbers from lawyers. And what we testify to is not evidence, it's argument. And Loxtercamp, basically, all Loxtercamp held was that the prima facie showing of a statutorily approved DMT test correctly administered was enough to support a license revocation when the driver provided no evidence to rebut that presumption of reliability. And Hayes held that a district court may, in the exercise of its discretion, exclude expert evidence challenging the reliability of a chemical test, not that it must do so. And I also wanted to state that term, oh, there they go again, there goes the defense bar again with that another margin of error, repackaged margin of error. It's not repackaged margin of error. It is a separate issue. Bias is a separate issue, and we believe that it was properly raised. And one last thing I'd like to say, that to say that the legislature accounted for margin of error or uncertainty of measurement by lowering the level of the 0.08 is just simply not true. We were losing millions and millions and millions of dollars in state highway funds because we were the last state to go from a 0.10 to a 0.08. That's why we're a 0.08 state, not because the legislature decided to account for margin of error or any other problem with the machine. Your Honor, as I stated from the very beginning, this case is about the admissibility of evidence. Your Honors are the gatekeepers. The courts are the gatekeepers of that evidence. The legislature allowed for the tests to be challenged, and we would respectfully request that you find that the district court erred when it determined that the expert testimony would not be helpful to the trier of fact. And if I could, very briefly, with my last couple of seconds, and I know you guys have a very busy calendar, what struck me at that hearing, and I remember it bright as day, and I have it in here, is at that hearing, we were talking about whether or not that testimony would come in. And we were talking about the number of, Mr. Kohler was talking about the number of variables and characteristics, and the expert testimony at issue would go into great detail in defining all of those variables and characteristics with this test and this machine. And the court said, well, how long is that testimony? And Mr. Kohler says, approximately an hour. And the court goes, oh, geez. And right when the district court said that, I said, you know what, there's no way he's going to let this evidence in, and there's no way that we're going to have, he's not going to allow this expert to testify. And he didn't. I would respectfully request that you reverse the district court and allow the expert testimony, and I believe we overcame Olson by raising it under 8 and subdivision 10. Thank you, Your Honors. Have a nice day.
Thank you, Mr. Durkin. Thank you to both attorneys. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days. Counsel in the second case may come forward and get ready.